Welcome back to Trailblaze. I'm Jamal Simmons and Matt Butler. We have joining us today a very special guest. Adam Green is here from the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, PCCC. He's here to talk to us about what they think on the progressive lane is going to happen with the presidential campaign, with some current candidates, and how all this is going to roll into 2028. Adam, welcome to Trailblaze.
Great to be here with you guys.
Adam, I think a lot of people have been talking about one, James Tallarico, who is now the Democratic nominee for the U.S. Senate in Texas. PCCC was pretty influential in endorsing him. And I think, you know, if he's able to pull off winning the Senate race, and that's a huge if in Texas, though, he is going to be in the mix for at least to be talked about as a potential presidential candidate. So we are we would love to learn more about him here on Trailblaze because we are all about 2028. So I guess if you could start with just sort of telling us about kind of how you guys came to endorse Tallarico and kind of how you find him, what you think about him, and kind of give us your take on James Tallarico.
Sure thing. And first, I would note that, you know, our theory of the case for the year is that 2026 is a valuable opportunity to prove the concept that in key swing states or districts, bold, inspiring economic populists who want to shake up the system and be connected with working people can win. So that when 2027, 2028 primary voters are thinking about who to vote for, and honestly, when candidates are thinking about whether to run, it's clear that there's a market for that. So Tallarico was one of the earliest primaries. And I'll just say, you know, I wasn't sure what to make of him when we interviewed him the first week of the year. And there was such a cogency to his worldview when he was talking about different questions we asked him. All of it boiled down to fighting for everyday people, challenging powerful interests, and structural change. And, you know, all of us have algorithms on Instagram and stuff like that. And I was just so impressed, video after video that I saw, where he would be asked, you know, about the Republican trope of welfare queens. And he'd say, you know who the welfare queens are? Corporations who refuse to pay their taxes, leaving the rest of us footing the bill. And someone would be like, oh, are you declaring class warfare? And he'd say stuff like, we've had class warfare declared on us for the last 50 years. Billionaires are winning. It's time for someone to fight back. And he didn't need notes to say these answers to people in the audience. That's just the fabric of what he was talking about. So that very much, you know, we wanted to prove that that kind of message could win. And if he can pull a giant upset in the general election in Texas, that would quite prove the point.
Wow. And Tallarico did a really good job, I thought, of blending, from my perspective, blending in faith in this argument of why he was for some of these positions that some might consider to be edgy. I think you're making a good, compelling point that they are closer to where most Americans are than they are to the edge. But the fact that he's grounding it in something that 70% of Americans or more still believe in, which is like some rooted faith in God, even if they don't go to church every week, they still kind of view the world through an ethical lens that comes from their faith. Rooting it in that, I think, is a really important thing.
Yeah. You know, whenever we support a candidate, I really challenge myself to get to the state and knock some doors just to hear what people are saying. And the number of people who hit that exact point, Jamal, on the doors was quite profound for me. People who were like, you know, they were sick of Christianity being abused on behalf of the right wing and thought that he was a credible messenger fighting back and, you know, going to bat for those who have needs, going to bat against powerful interests are wrapped in this rubric of morality that he's talking about. So to me, it's all one big issue. And, you know, the messenger matters, as both of you know. And it's really exciting to see what he could do. Last night, I was at a John Oliver, Seth Meyers show, and they took a little Q&A at the end. And they were talking about how, you know, they've gotten their hopes up so many times around Texas and they feel like losing in the football, but they're willing to get behind this again because it just feels hopeful, especially in this election year. So we're putting some chips on the table and hopefully this will be a big win. We'll see.
That's great. You know, I note that like he was really down in the polls, not too far out from the election. I mean, I think he was down at least 10 points like in late February. And he's going into the general, I assume whether Cornyn or Paxton wins, he's going to be the underdog. What was the key to him being able to overcome that, that deficit in those last 2 weeks of the campaign?
Yeah, you know, when we spoke to him in early January, he had a pretty clear theory of the case. He was like, I'm behind. partly because of name recognition, but among those who know us both, I'm winning. And therefore, it's a race against time to get our message out there, get my name ID up, and let the message, you know, speak for itself. And that's really, you know, a big part of what happened. It wasn't just name ID, it was the name connected to the message. You know, the Colbert thing at the end really did help juice his fundraising, which allowed him to stay high volume for those final days when people were voting. That was important. And for us, you know, part of what extra motivated us to get involved was talking to reporters between January and, I guess, late February, and hearing from so many of them who were surprised to hear that we were inclined to support him. I guess they just thought we would be behind Jasmine Crockett. And, you know, because she is known as a very effective partisan jouster, she excites people. Her name ID is high for a reason. You know, I like her a lot personally. But part of what we saw this campaign breaking down as was a choice between, is being an effective partisan jouster, is being anti-Trump sufficient? Or do we want to have a forward-looking vision, including one that connects with working people on economic values? And obviously, we're in that second camp. And if we want to build a durable majority that can win not just in huge anti-Trump years, but forever. So the only question is, how big is the Democratic majority? Not, are we descending into fascism in the bad years? We think that having a vision is really important. So, you know, we were, I had no idea going to Election Day what would happen. You know, I think it was a fool's errand to know, you know, say you know for sure. But it was gratifying to see that as voters paid attention, they went with someone that they thought had a compelling message for the future. So hopefully that will be a set of dominoes that falls in upcoming primaries. And we have a Democratic Party that leaves this cycle knowing that having a vision, one that connects with working people, is where the future of the party should be, not just being anti-Trump.
So how do you guys see that playing out in the general election?
Across states?
Well, no, in Texas, right? Well, so he gets through a primary, and this is the argument. The argument is, right, maybe you can get through a primary with a strong progressive message, but does that message sell in a general election to a much broader electorate? And I think you must have a theory of the case about why it does.
Yes. If I were getting advice from one Jamal Simmons, I'd probably be told not to put my hat entirely on Texas. You know, we are looking at some swingier swing states like Maine, like Michigan, and some swing districts that will also have a lot of chips behind. But, you know, clearly he has a chance in Texas. I do think that him winning the primary opened up the doors to funders being willing to invest and not consider it fool's gold. I think that will actually have down ballot impact for Dina Hinojosa, who is running for Texas, where the money might not be there if he was not the nominee.
For governor. Running for governor.
Governor, I'm sorry, yes. Yeah. So, you know, let me be a little conservative and say, you know, maybe you have a 45% chance of winning, which is not to say we'll get 45% of the vote. But, you know, I think Republicans always start off with a default win in a place like Texas. But hey, if we're ever going to win, what would have to be true?
So let's do the comparison. Let's do the comparison then before we move on out of here, which is I think the argument of the Crockett team was that we've spent several cycles betting on wooing these elusive white independent middle of the road voters to come to the Democratic side, and they always let us down. So her argument was, maybe I can excite more energy out of our base communities and out of some of the more progressive parts of the party that might, and then steal whatever votes I can out of the middle, and that might give us a better chance to go into the general election. I think Tallarico obviously had a different theory of the case. You guys must have agreed with that. So just maybe not can he or will he win? I know you certainly believe he can win. But versus Crockett or someone else who may have been more of a excitement motivator for the traditional thoughts of the Democratic base, how do you see that playing out, that he's a better candidate in the general election than somebody like Jasmine Crockett would have been?
Yeah. Well, first, you know, one thing we saw, which was encouraging, was Latino voters very much were enthusiastic about his candidacy. Latino voters who we've been losing in Texas, you know, are coming back into the fold with a working class message that he had. Also, I think, you know, appealing to them on a values morality front. And, you know, I'm of the firm belief that we need both. You know, I worked in a South Dakota Senate race back in the day, where in a very good year for Republicans, we ended up winning by 527 votes. And it was because the base there, which is the Native American community, came out in record numbers, and we wooed very culturally conservative evangelical farmers and ranchers on economic issues. And literally every one of those votes we needed to win. So I believe we need both, especially in, you know, redder states. So I think she's been a great team player in terms of, you know, doing initial steps to unite the party. You know, firmly believe that having a multiracial working class coalition has to be the future. And again, I think our goal should be not eking out a 50% plus one vote share in good years, but building a durable supermajority so that we can absorb some backtracking in our math during the less good years. That has to be where we land.
All right. So I have to ask you, does that mean James Tallarico for president?
I'm not ready to go there yet. I'd be really curious your thoughts on this. I mean, I feel like Obama did a record turnaround, you know, waiting 2 years in the Senate before announcing his candidacy. I guess it is hard for me to logistically imagine someone who just got elected to the Senate for the first time running for president. This would apply to others as well, like Graham Platner in Maine or Abdul El-Sayed in Michigan. You know, I think it's probably more likely that someone like Raphael Warnock or John Ossoff decides to run. You know, people who are inspiring and proving the point in red states that they can win with working class populist messages. But if he decided to throw his hat in the ring, I think he would instantly be in the top five. You know, if he had just won a Texas Senate seat, no doubt about it. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, from a math perspective, I mean, if we can put Texas into play, I mean, it's almost game over for the Republicans. So if you've got a person who can win statewide in Texas, that's obviously going to be very attractive. I wonder if the more likely scenario is the Lyndon Baines Johnson play, and you put him on the ticket as the vice president to really try to shore that up. So I think it will be interesting. But, you know, look, in the prediction markets, he's gone from like he was at one or two at the end of February, and now he's trading at four or five. So he's almost doubled what people think he can do. So, well, you know, he's got to get through the Senate race first, though. And yeah, I feel like I've been Charlie Brown so many times, hoping against hope, you know, especially when it's against Ted Cruz, you know, and just to see us crash again and again, it's so demoralizing. But this, it seems like this is different.
So, but Adam, you have to know one of the Trailblaze themes here, the subplots that happens around here, is Matt's beat is the prediction markets. I mean,
I like to follow them. I have no money in the prediction. Just to be clear, I have no money in the prediction markets at this point, but I do like to follow it.
Oh, so that makes you different than the Trump administration, because it's clear somebody in the Trump administration.
They've got lots of money in the, yeah,
they are
lots
betting,
of money,
right?
In the prediction. Yes.
I won $8 last night betting on Michael B. Jordan to win the
best. Nice. Congratulations. It doesn't matter how much you win, winning on something where your brain is involved feels that's the best feeling. So.
But awesome. To your point on VP, that actually feels more logistically real to me because, you know, assume he wins the election, he needs to get his bearing, he's going to want to set up his shop. You know, he basically would have a year in the Senate to, like, get ground under his feet before being selected as VP, right? So yep. that actually feels a little bit more real. I would bet on that one, Matt.
How do you know how a senator is replaced in Texas? Like, do we have to win the governor's race too? Because you wouldn't want to lose. If you win a Texas Senate seat, well, that is not one we're going to want to give up. So, and that's got to be taken into consideration when you're thinking about putting him on the ticket.
That's a good point. I have not done that research, but.
Although I got to tell you, if the good news is he wouldn't have to give up the seat to run. And if we could trade, a Texas Senate seat for the White House.
Oh, for the White House. Yes.
I'll take the trade.
Yes, we'll take it. We'll take it. We will take it.
Yeah. So. I'll take that trade every day.
Adam, you mentioned Ossoff, you mentioned Warnock. Is there anybody else that you are particularly interested in or seeing how they're going to do or kind of what they're going to do in getting ready for this race over the next year when we're sort of in invisible primary mode?
Yeah. Well, first I just Googled it and the Texas governor would appoint a temporary replacement.
Oh, yeah. All right, good. Yeah. So we got a roof for both.
Roof and also, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, this is something I'm really eager to talk with you all about. You know, I've been encouraging everybody to kind of see politics with a different set of lenses, which is insider versus outsider, more so than left versus right or anything like that. And, you know, it's funny, I was on a panel maybe 8 months ago.
You and I have had this conversation. We've had this conversation over drinks. The outsider the outsider versus the insider model.
Let's just stop it now then.
Yes. Not that either one of us like a cocktail, you know, that never happens.
Never. So I was on this panel in the UK and I heard all of these labor kind of related people talking about the Reform Party there. And the Reform Party there is Nigel Farage, basically kind of the fascist in waiting, who were growing in popularity. And they kept saying, reform wants to do this, reform wants to do that. And I looked at them, you know, on the stage at this panel thing, and I was like, hey, I'm the fresh ear here. I just have to tell you, reform sounds really good. Yeah. And if people think about like a crusty barnacled conservative party and a crusty barnacled labor party and a fresh new reform party, don't give them that mantle. You have to drag them into the mud. Maybe they're the far right reform party or something.
Yeah.
And this person came up to me afterwards and she was like, I'm a linguist. I think you're right. And I was like, you're not a good linguist. I never thought about this before. Right. But, you know, to me, the tension I feel is that we can run outsiders quite easily for House and for Senate. It's plausible for an oyster farmer to win a Senate seat in Maine. Sure, why not? There's an expectation of gravitas when running for president that is at tension with the typical people we feel are on the bench. And it's like, well, is a governor an outsider? It's like, I don't know, maybe. Is Pritzker really an outsider? I have no idea. But that's a tension I grapple with of like, how do you have someone that captures the outsider vibe while being credible and on the bench? And I don't know, that's the thing.
But you know who has that? Democrats have that more than Republicans do. Republicans don't give a shit about credibility and gravitas. Right. I mean, obviously, look at Donald Trump, right? For the first case in point. But then also, you could look at George W. Bush. I mean, the critique of W. back in 2000 was that he was an intellectual lightweight. He wasn't curious. He didn't read. Condi Rice was like holding his hand and tutoring him in foreign policy. Whoever promotes that they have been tutored in foreign policy, right? But they were like leaning into that back in 2000. We always, the Democrats, you know, we think like, oh, you know, Al Gore, he's super smart, or, you know, here's, you know, even Gary Hart, I'm too young for this, but like, you know, this idea that he was like this new thinking guy, we're always kind of leaning into that. Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, Donald Trump, they just throw a winner that people might like, throw them at the process and let's see what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead. No, Adam, go.
Yeah. So for that reason, you know, I think about, again, I think a Warnock would actually potentially have outsider vibes. And, you know, I don't know all of his issue positions, but I think I generally would like his values. You know, Ossoff, if he just won re-election. You know, I think maybe a union leader would be interesting, right? One of the Seans, UAW Teamsters, probably more UAW in my book. Or I challenge myself, and I'm willing to get, you know, just shot down immediately on this, but like, should we run a Stephen Colbert, right? Should we run someone who also actually, in his case, has, you know, Christian values, but someone
who's... The Zelensky play. That's the Zelensky play. The Zelensky. Right, comedian. Right?
It's also like the Donald Trump play, right? Like somebody who is part of pop culture, is not seen as an outsider, but, you know, is politically involved enough. I don't know, but I don't just kind of go through the typical set of people on the bench. I will say one thing. I think Gavin Newsom is a non-starter. I just think that he is so... If you think creature of the inside versus shake up the system outsider and you apply the name Gavin Newsom, to me, it's just so obvious he's a creature of the inside. I think he's an overvalued stock and overvalued in the betting markets, Matt. So if you can sell him short, I would do that.
Well, the two people.
Yeah, I mean, they agree with you. They agree with you. He's been going down and down and down the last 2 months. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wouldn't bet it. I wouldn't count him out yet. I mean, one thing about Gavin that he's able to do, and I'm not, I know I seem like sometimes I'm singing the Gavin song, but only because I think he's being really adept at how he's playing the game. And I think one thing that he does really well is he finds a way to get ahead of where most people are in their thinking. And he is doing it in a way that sort of looks courageous and fearless and funny and all that stuff. And I think a lot of regular Democrats are like, seems kind of like fine to me. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, I'd never count out good looking rich white dudes. I mean, America has had a string of success with that model. So I wouldn't count it out just yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's been the best taking on Trump, and he stood up to Trump and people like that. And they look at him as a fighter. And so that's, you know, I think that's why he's got this early lead. But there is something I will, for people who are really into this, I will commend, Nate Silver and, Galen Druk have done these like two presidential drafts. And the one that they did for the Democrats, you know, they said, applaud if you want this person to be the nominee. And I understand this is like a comedy club in Brooklyn on like a Tuesday night. So this is not like broad, but like there were groans when he brought up Gavin Newsom's name. So that was not good. And then for Kamala Harris, they're like applaud. And the audience was silent. Ouch. And then they laughed. And then they did it again at the end. And again, silence for Kamala Harris. Again, not scientific, but you know, if either of these people are they're the front runners in either the polling or in the prediction markets, and it just seems like there is a a real reticence to get behind their candidacies. So there's something about both of them that are rubbing people the wrong way.
Who got the most applause?
I think Pete Buttigieg, which is not super surprising given that demo. So yeah.
About Gavin real quick.
Yeah.
I think he kind of encapsulates the dynamic I was describing before about, are we an anti-Trump party or do we have a forward-looking vision that positions itself on the side of working people? I mean, him right now threatening to veto a wealth tax and opposing a wealth tax referendum on the ballot in California, to me, is the tell, right? That's like when push comes to shove, he will not challenge power. He's not saying, oh, wait, I think it was structured wrong. Let me offer a better wealth tax.
Because I get into this argument with my my Republican family from California all the time, like he is against a California wealth tax. I believe he has said a national wealth tax he would be behind. The California wealth tax, he thinks that you're going to have some of your wealthiest citizens just leave, and that actually isn't good for California. So from like from the perspective of a governor, like there could be some nuance here, but the real tell will be is if somebody's proposing a national wealth tax and he's behind that, then I think you get your answer. So,
I mean, to kind of take on the voice of Adam Green in this conversation, that would be that argument for him is the same argument people have waged about the living wage or about raising the minimum wage. That if you raise it in one state, then that would be bad because people will flee and jobs will get created in another. And what we found when it comes to wages is that's just not true. People, adjust to the wages, and I think with the wealth tax, that will also not be true. Sure, there'll be some people. High-profile people who will leave. But there are people who live in California because they like living in California.
Right.
And, if you lose like $100 million or something, like, and you're worth $20 billion, I don't know that that's going to make you uproot your entire life and go somewhere.
I think you're right. And like other people have said smarter than me, like I would pay 10% to live in New York or California rather than Florida or Texas. Like I would. It would absolutely positively be worth it to me. But you've got to remember on the wealth tax front, like if you were talking about the change in minimum wage, like a person who owns three or four franchises of, McDonald's franchises or Hardee's franchises, they are less able to just pick up and go. Whereas, somebody who's worth $1 trillion or, $500 billion, they actually can just go. And it's going to be that big of a thing. So there's slightly different universes that we're talking about. So now look, I am for the wealth tax nationally, like let's get it everywhere. The whole point is on Newsom, I think we do, he's going to have to really grow a lot as a candidate and connecting sort of authentically with people to be a real viable alternative probably.
Yeah. But two names we have not brought up, Adam. I want to get you in on. We have not brought up the Arizonans. We have not talked about either Ruben Gallego, Senator, or Senator Mark Kelly, who is, you just say astronaut, fighter pilot, Senator. You got any opinions about either one of those?
Yeah. I mean, I think Ruben, if he ever decides to run for president, would, also be in the top, 5-6. I consider him an authentic, he's definitely an authentic fighter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's he fighting for? He's generally fighting for good things. He has an Achilles heel with crypto and some things, I think some sacrifices he made when running to take that money and get their support, which I don't think is aging well and will continue to not age well. AI will be the next iteration of that, where big industry players are trying to have disproportionate voice in the current process. It's happening this week in Illinois. But no doubt about it, he, if I had to list a number of politicians that I liked, he's on that list. Mark Kelly would be less so. Here's what I like about Mark Kelly. I was once at a DSCC event where I didn't really know much about him. It was early in his career, his Senate career. And he said something like, he leveraged his astronaut cred to say, the number of days in Arizona that are over like 130 degrees, per year is going up and up and up. And he goes, we have one planet. There is no fallback option. We need to take climate change seriously. And I was like, oh, good for you. Like, that's a great way to use your astronaut cred.
So I'm glad
he exists. And he's doing it again now with the military stuff.
Yeah.
I'll just say, I happened to be in Arizona the week that Harris announced Tim Walz as her running mate. We were doing a candidate training there for local candidates. And it pretty much disrupted our training because all the trainees wanted to go to this big rally. So we all went. And and Mark Kelly and Gabby Giffords came out together. And she, by all accounts of the local Arizona residents, gave the best speech that she's given since she was shot. Mm. Like, it was just like, you know, she was able to speak. It was a beautiful speech. The crowd was erupting, you know, 15, 20,000 people. And then Mark Kelly starts speaking. And it was the most boring speech. So much so that at one point he paused. The people backstage thought he was done, and they basically played him off stage. Oh. It was like, oh, I guess I'm done. Okay, bye. Yeah. And I was like, oh boy, I'm so glad she did not pick him. And I just feel like, honestly, he's not going to be the person that we want to put up in front of an audience in a way that just riles people up in a good way. I think I'm glad he is where he is. I'm very happy with that, but I don't think he's the future.
That is,
we like astronauts in the Senate, right? Yeah. I mean, we got to go way
John
back.
Glenn,
John Glenn that, right? from my home state of Ohio. Like, oh, yeah. I love the man, but did not go, that prep campaign did not go well.
Yeah,
and carried debt well into the late 2000s.
It was true. That's so, true. It was expensive gambit.
The late aughts.
What's your current take on Ruben Gallego? Have you talked about him before, and where do you see his feeling?
We haven't spoken too much about him. We should get Chuck on about him. See what Chuck Rocha is, because he'll be interesting. Yeah,
yeah.
But again, the crypto thing is a little annoying. I wish he didn't.
Well, yeah, I want to go back to that because the thing about crypto, and I have been a skeptic for a long time, but when I talk to my friends and family who are not into politics really at all, especially the black guys. 35 to 55, a lot of them are in crypto. A lot of them are like kind of enamored with like Bitcoin. Like they're kind of like, yeah, this cryptocurrency stuff, you guys are missing the boat. There's something here. People are making money, you know, in this space. And I think that might be like one of the places where we're talking about men and bringing wooing men back to the Democratic Party or to the left. I don't know that we should have a hard line on it.
I don't buy the idea that there are a lot of crypto voters who are like crossing party lines because of that issue, but but maybe. My critique is less about crypto itself. Just like, you know, I use ChatGPT and I aspire now to use Claude the more I learn about Anthropic, but that's different from saying that the people who are trying to rewrite the rules of society should have free reign and get that free reign because they are disproportionately funding politicians, right? What worries me about the lesson that crypto learned last cycle and Elon Musk learned last cycle is that they basically get infinite ROI, infinite return on investment for going big, bludgeoning Democratic politicians, right? I mean, crypto had a goal, defeat Sherrod Brown. They spent at least $40 million, it might have landed higher than that, to blow him out of the water. And they are thrilled about that. And I've talked to some people in crypto since then being like, you know, you now run the show. Trump has the White House. You have the majority. Are you going to go easy on Sherrod Brown this cycle? They're like, hell no, we hate that guy. They want to blow him out of the water again, right? Elon Musk spent $200 million plus to elect Donald Trump. And within weeks of Trump winning, his fortune went up $200 billion, right? Think about that ROI. So that scares me a lot, right? And I mean, crypto is rewriting the rules of, you know, our finances. AI is going to rewrite the rules of everything. And the next few years are so important that, you know, even if you like AI, you shouldn't be for them, you know.
So this gets to language. This gets to language. It's one of the questions before we wrap up. It's one of the questions I think I wanted us to talk about, which is, are we anti-crypto or are we anti-AI or are we pro, you know, privacy, pro-worker, pro-innovation with future? I'm like, or are we like, are we anti-corporate or are we anti-big pharma? Are we like, I think we have to be careful that we don't like just completely block out entire industries because this is still America. America is a capitalist society. But we are clear what we're for about what they're doing and what we're against. Are we pro entrepreneurship? You know, are we pro consumer rights? Are we pro, you know what I mean? Like, what are we for, as you talked about in the beginning, and not just what are we against and doing big broad brushes?
I 100% agree. You know, I think you can be for guardrails in AI. Yeah. You can be for legitimate debate, but not letting those with the most money just can have every seat at the table, right? I mean, that's what it really boils down to. I mean, right now with crypto, they pretty much have every seat at the table. I mean, David Sacks, who runs, you know, the main crypto podcast, is now in the White House as the cryptos are. Yeah. And nobody in Congress is challenging that. I mean, they've won that. Maybe we'll have more seats at the table in the future after this election, but that's very scary. And again, AI is a much bigger stake for society. But I completely agree with you. You know, I think that, you know, as somebody who is part of the whole anti-monopoly community, it's like, if you're pro innovation, if you're pro entrepreneur, if you're new actors, pro new job creators in the market, you don't want the old crusty incumbents just controlling the whole market because they have more political power, right? Yep. So, or more economic market power. So yeah, I totally agree with you. We need to be intentional about our language. May I add one last point though? You know, last cycle, we were invited by the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee to present some economic polling to frontline candidates, red to blue candidates. And we were invited on with a group called Third Way, which I know you're both familiar with, which, you know, have admitted publicly that the majority of their funding comes from Wall Street donors. And I asked the DCCC, I'm like, are you sure you want us both advising candidates on economic policy? Because we have very different views. And they were like, okay, they're going to talk about immigration. You'll talk about economics. I was like, all right. And basically what we were showing was as rising costs were happening and inflation was a big focal point in the 2024 election, we were recommending that candidates talk about corporate price gouging. And we tested 20 different versions of it. And corporate price gouging of groceries was by far, you know, the most important thing to talk about. And the Third Way folks heard what we were saying and they kind of intervened and conceded the point. It's like, yes, we should be talking about this, you know. But they were like, don't paint a broad brush. People like corporations. Corporations are employers. Just focus on the bad apples. And what we did after that was in two polls in a row, we did, you know, A-B testing, which you're both familiar with, basically dividing our sample in half, making the same argument, but in two different ways. And one argument was our original wording, which was Democrats want to take on greedy corporations that are jacking up your prices at the grocery store, at the gas pump, et cetera. And the other one was most corporations are good, but for those that are bad actors, we need to call them out, blah, blah, blah. And every time that lost.
Well, that was a sink.
Yeah,
I mean, you just wrapped a tire around that last one and threw it.
Well, it's funny you say that because I kept emailing them, being like, "Do you have language we can test?"
Yeah,
and we really took our best faith effort twice at approximating their language. They were like, "We'd have no language."
Just couldn't
like,
do it.
Jamal, if you want to give me some better stuff to test,
I would test because I actually like greedy corporations. I think as long as if you modify it, then I think it's helpful, right?
Yeah,
like greedy corporations.
I think it gets to what they want you to do, right?
Yeah. Who's for greed, right? Like, well, the current people are in charge, but who on the left is for like greedy corporation? So like greedy corporations are bad, and then you could be like, you know, these. You know, greedy real estate interests or like big pharma that's taking all of our money and betting it on like in the stock market, right? Like that's the take I'm saying. I'm not saying say like, oh, some like a analytical argument about whether or not corporations are good or bad, but like let's pick the ones that are bad and nail the shit out of them. You know,
I'm game. To me, they both achieve the same goal, which is challenging power. And I genuinely thought that what I thought was their language would win and was surprised both times when it didn't. And I desperately was asking them for language. The similar thing is there are some politicians who say don't challenge billionaires because everybody wants to be a billionaire. And I just am not aware of any polling that backs that up. I'm open to how to test it. But the idea that we would be like, oh, we want affordability without saying who is standing in the way of affordability, without naming any villain, just seems politically like malpractice to me. So, you know, I hope to engage with more good faith actors on this line of thought, but my starting point is you have to be willing to name a villain, whether it's corporate greed, whether it's billionaires who are abusing workers or not paying their taxes, and open to messaging advice from there.
All right. Name a villain. I think that's the way we're going to wrap this up. Let's name a villain and go after him hard. You are not the villain, though, Adam. You are a constructive
player. Good friend. Thank you very much for coming on. This has been great.
Thank you.